from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. As the U.S. House votes to repeal the new health care law, Americans are split on the issue, and President Obama's popularity is on the rise. Also, a formal state visit by China's president, Hu Jintao, begins today. Analysis of these stories and other political news this hour with two guests from Drake University, Rachel Caulfield of the Department of Politics and International Relations, and Dennis Goldford, professor of political science. What are your thoughts on efforts to repeal the new health care law? On U.S.-China relations. Join our discussion after this news. It's The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and it's Politics Wednesday here on The Exchange. It's our weekly chance to analyze and discuss the latest political news, also with you. This week, as the U.S. House votes to repeal the new health care law, Americans, it turns out, are split on the issue. And President Obama's popularity is on the rise. Also, a formal state visit by China's President Hu Jintao begins today. Governor Branstad, in his first week of office, what are his budget priorities? We'll talk about those a little bit later in the program. Our analysts this week, both from Drake University in Des Moines, Dennis Goldford is with us, professor of political science. Good afternoon to you, Dennis.
Good afternoon.
Great to have you back with us alongside Dennis at our studios in Des Moines. Rachel Caulfield, associate professor in the Department of Politics and International Relations, also a research fellow with the American Judicature Society Hunter Center for Judicial Selection at Drake. Rachel Caulfield, thank you for joining us again.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And we want to start with the health care repeal. The new Republican-led House is poised to deliver an emphatic thumbs down to President Barack Obama's landmark health care overhaul. The House voted could vote today to turn out to be, the high watermark for a repeal, a goal that energized conservative voters in the midterm elections and helped Republicans return to power in Congress. Democrats who hung on to the Senate have vowed to block the GOP drive. Here's what White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs had to say yesterday about the move in the U.S. House to vote to repeal the health care law.
I would share the belief of many, including, I think, enunciated by those who are going to vote for repeal tomorrow, that this isn't a serious legislative effort. I think, first and foremost, they've largely acknowledged that. I don't think it's going anywhere. I do think it's an important symbol to the American people about who some people think should be in charge of making healthcare decisions, not families or patients or doctors, but let's put health insurance companies back in charge, giving them the ability again to drop, deny, limit, or cap your healthcare coverage.
White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs yesterday. Listeners, we want to hear from you in this first half hour about health care. What are your thoughts about the effort to repeal the health care law? What do you like about it? What do you object to? Are you one of those who benefits from the new law? 1-866-780-9100. The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Our email, tweet us at IPR. Talk 1-866-780-9100. So let's turn to Dennis and Rachel. Symbolic, with the Senate Democrats vowing to block the GOP in this move, just a symbolic vote. What is the significance of it? Let's start with you, Dennis, please.
Symbolism matters in politics. Yes, this is going nowhere. This is the equivalent of the batter promising to step up to the plate. And even though he's not going to get on base, he's at least taking a bat, and striking out doesn't seem to matter. The important thing was he stepped up to the plate. Mm-hmm. And Republicans are engaging in symbolism, but they owe this to their constituency. Their constituency, something like 3/4 to 4/5 of Republicans, want this repealed, and they would be in big trouble with that Republican base if they did not take this vote, even if it will be unsuccessful.
Mm-hmm. The shooting rampage in Tucson postponed this vote that was originally scheduled for last week. Rachel, has that tragedy, you think, changed the tone of the debate in any way on health care?
Well, I don't think it's changed the debate in a significant way. You know, we as a nation, we love to scapegoat our discourse, our uncivil discourse, as kind of being at fault for any number of things that we don't like about our politics. But at the end of the day, I'm not sure that – first of all, I'm not sure that our uncivil discourse is to blame for a lot of the things that we say that it is. But furthermore, I'm not sure that talking about it a whole lot is going to change the tone. Mm-hmm. You know, Republicans ran on this, obviously, in the midterm elections. They need the vote. They're going to get the vote. But, you know, polling is indicating that the American people are completely split down the middle. This is not a clear home run for the Republicans, except among their base voters.
Mm-hmm. It was interesting to say when we talk about discourse, about tone, the bill is no longer called the job killing bill. It is called the job destroying bill.
That's right. Yes. We've stepped up on the rhetoric just a little bit.
Let's talk a little bit about the polls that you mentioned there, Rachel. The new national poll indicates that given the same choice lawmakers will face today between repealing the whole measure or keeping it all in place, half of all Americans prefer the repeal. What can you and Dennis add about how Americans feel about this new law when surveyed? Let's pull it apart a little bit. How did opinions differ when you look at demographics, gender, social class, age, those kinds of things?
Well, you know, first of all, I think the leading driver on opinion here is ideology, and it is partisanship. One of the things that the Obama administration, I think, really missed an opportunity on was to fully explain what this bill does. You know, they went ahead and they got it through on the premise that once you get it through, it's harder to throw away everything than it is to pick it apart. And our survey results at this point are pretty much showing that, you know, people, even if they don't like the whole thing, they like bits of it. They don't want to get rid of the whole thing. And so now that it's in place and it operates as a kind of status quo, it becomes harder to undo. And that's exactly what the administration was depending on. And it seems to be working for them.
Mm-hmm. And even if the Senate were to be in GOP hands, they would have to get even more than that because the president has promised a veto. Isn't that correct? Is this how that works? It would be another big hurdle.
Well, it'd be two big hurdles. They'd have to pass it over a filibuster, which means they'd need 60 votes to get cloture. And then they'd have to, if the president were to veto it, they'd have to get the 2/3 vote to override the veto.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to our first caller, 1-866-780-9100. What's your opinion on this attempt to repeal the new health care law? 1-866-780-9100. Does it affect your life? Tell us how. Tell us your story as it is affected by this new health care law. 1-866-780-9100. Craig is with us in Cedar Rapids. Good afternoon, Craig.
Good afternoon.
Yes,
I'm a Republican, but I speak like a Democrat, which all Republicans could do, so that we could work together as fellow Americans to make things better for everybody. And I feel health care is more an ethical, moral thing than it is a business, and we need everybody covered because it's the right thing to do instead of waiting to go to the emergency room and when the condition is really bad, and then, you know, costing much more money that way.
Mm-hmm. And so are you reaching out to fellow Republicans and saying, wait a minute, let's consider this?
Oh, I do all the time. I drive them crazy, and we just got to start caring more about everybody in this country instead of in these areas, because when you're sick and you need help.
Okay, Craig, thank you very much for your opinion. Craig joining us from Cedar Rapids. Let's move over to Coralville. Jim is joining us. Hi, Jim. Welcome to The Exchange.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead, Jim. What's on your mind?
Okay. Well, big thing is that I have to ask why all these Congress critters who tend to be lawyers focused almost entirely on the insurance companies and not one word spoken about tort reform, which is what really drives up the insurance rates and makes the health care so much more expensive. So why didn't these lawyers gore their own ox, as it were?
Mm-hmm. Okay, Jim, let's see if either of our experts today has anything to say about that. Rachel or Dennis, go ahead if you do.
Well, I'm not an expert on the issue of tort reform in the medical field, but that has been a standard Republican argument for some time. And some doctors certainly do practice defensive medicine. That is, they'll order certain tests they don't really think are necessary, but they're concerned about being sued if, in fact, something does turn up. But I haven't seen any figures in some time, but the ones I can remember suggest that the issue of malpractice suits adds perhaps a couple of percentage points to the cost of health care overall. In other words, in absolute terms, it's a lot of money for any of us. But in terms of percentage of health care expenditures, it really is relatively small.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to a point that an earlier caller made about bipartisanship, about working together, our caller from Cedar Rapids. The administration says now it opposes the repeal, it has all along, of course, but is open to Republican suggestions about improving the provision. And that has marked a shift from last year when the president and congressional Democrats repeatedly blasted the GOP for not backing the law and cast them as uncaring of the millions who would gain health insurance under it. So I'm wondering, Rachel, does this bipartisan tone, at least from the White House, translate, you think, into bipartisan legislation? More than talk here?
Well, I think let's be clear about the fact that, in his own words, President Obama took a shellacking last November. You know, he came into office on this tide of being post-partisan, not just bipartisan, but above politics altogether, which quite frankly, always struck me as an interesting claim, particularly when he was running for the Democratic nomination. I don't know how one can be post-partisan when you're running for your party's nomination. But, you know, he's always prided himself on this idea and this image that he's above politics and certainly above petty partisan politics. Given the November election results, Obama needs to regain his footing in terms of being that bipartisan picture that the American people keep saying that they want.
I would add that there are two political considerations going on here that Rachel's adverted to. One is, of course, that with a Republican-controlled House and a much diminished majority in the Senate, the president has no choice but to attempt to work with Republicans, as opposed to being able, to the extent you can organize any fractious Democrats. But beforehand, he could pretty much dictate the terms. But the second political consideration is that although there aren't that many pure independents around. Most independents tend to lean toward one party or the other. Still, what happened to the Democrats this time was that the bottom fell out in their support among independents. And the independents were a key to the election of Barack Obama and the Democratic victories in 06 and congressional victories in 08. And it's independents who, certainly more than partisans, want to talk in terms of being bipartisan. So these political considerations, I think, come into play very strongly here as well.
And although we just ended an election cycle, I think it's worth noting that we're going into an election cycle.
Yes.
We're in
and,
it, not just
yeah,
going
I was saying,
into it.
We in Iowa know that probably better than anyone else in the country. But
so how will
there's
that
a lot at stake in 2012.
So at this point, what can you say about how health care and its possible repeal will figure into that 2012 campaign?
I think Republicans will, of course, they'll have the symbolic vote, but it won't go anywhere in the Senate. But they're going to try to use that vote to increase pressure on moderate Democrats or Democrats elected in fairly red Republican constituencies, congressional or senatorial. And they're going to use that focus on repeal as a rallying cry in the elections, not just for the presidency in 2012, but remember, there are 23 Democratic seats up for re-election in 2012 and only 10 Republican seats. So Democrats have a lot to defend, and this is a powerful wedge issue for Republicans.
Jake is joining us from Dubuque. Good afternoon, Jake. Welcome to The Exchange.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, go ahead quickly. We're coming up on a break, but we have time to get in your comment or question here.
Well, I wanted to ask, we obviously know it's symbolic this week what happens with the bill, but looking in the future, what do we see as the pieces of the bill that are most acceptable? Obviously, Obama with the new chief of staff, a few gestures towards the business community, knowing that he might have to concede. I'll take my answer off the embassy is, you know, the pieces that might be whittled away.
Okay, good question, Jake from Dubuque. The unpopular parts of this, we've listed in the past many of the popular ones, non-discrimination against pre-existing conditions, for example, staying on your parents' health care plan if you're in your early 20s. What might get whittled away, though, asks Jake.
It would be the individual mandate.
Yeah.
And, of course, that's being attacked not just politically but also constitutionally, the requirement that everybody buy health insurance or pay some sort of fee.
Okay. And that is also – that's being challenged in the courts as well. Iowa joining now half the other states in the union to do this, right? Tell us about that, Rachel.
Well, this is a lawsuit that's been brought challenging this individual mandate. It's also challenging provisions regarding state spending on health care for individual citizens. But it's most primarily focused on this mandate that each citizen have health care coverage. There was, it was a successful lawsuit in Virginia. At a lower court level, there's a question about how far it'll go. But as more states join this effort, it's seen to be more politically seem to put some political pressure on the court system to start to recognize what the real world ramifications of this are. Interesting in Iowa because the attorney general of Iowa actually submitted a brief arguing that the Health Care Reform Act was constitutional. So now he will not be representing the governor in this case. So the governor has determined, Governor Branstad has determined that the state will join the lawsuit, but our attorney general will not be fighting on behalf of the state.
We should note, though, that while the federal district court judge in Virginia held the at least the individual mandate or pieces of it unconstitutional, two other federal district courts held it constitutional.
Right.
So the opponents are batting one out of three at this point.
Okay. Crystal writes, I have been listening to the debate for the last several hours on cable news. I do benefit from many of the changes. I have a health condition that could easily cause me to hit the lifetime maximums or prevent me from being covered via the pre-existing conditions clause. I will live in fear until 2014 that when that goes into effect. And to be frank, I wanted a single-payer option. I am constantly dealing with health issues and have already spent about $1,000 this year just handling deductibles. I would much rather deal with the ethics of government bureaucracy than insurance bureaucracy. That's what Crystal writes to us. 1-866-780-9100, The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Tangential to this, President Obama's popularity. Well, let's look at a number of the latest polls in terms of popularity. According to a new USA Today Gallup poll, Obama's job approval rating, 47%, and that's precisely where it was in early January. His favorable rating, 53%. That's up a bit from recent months. House Speaker John Boehner, favorable rating at 42%. That's almost exactly where Nancy Pelosi stood when she became Speaker 4 years ago. This is interesting. Sarah Palin's favorable rating has dropped to 38%, the lowest since just after bursting onto the national scene as John McCain's running mate back in 2008. Now, in the wake of the controversy over her response to the Tucson shooting, her unfavorable rating has hit a new high, 53%. What are we to make of Obama's modest rebound and Palin's plummet?
We have to remember that the president, as people in a basic political science course know, wears two hats. The president is head of state and head of government. As head of government, the president is a partisan political figure. But the president, unlike any other politician, is also head of state. That is, he represents and symbolizes the nation. And if you think back to George W. Bush speaking after a space shuttle disaster on the behalf of national grief, or President Reagan speaking on behalf of national grief after the Challenger disaster, I guess it was in 1986. This is where the president, in some sense, expresses the grief of the nation as a community. That's what President Obama managed to do very well, whereas the response to Sarah Palin's video was suggestion across the web, more or less, that she acted as if the chief victim of these shootings was Sarah Palin herself, and that rubbed people the wrong way.
Many are lauding this as one of President Obama's best speeches. What made that so popular, this memorial service speech that he gave in Tucson?
Well, he did exactly what he needed to do, right? He gave voice to, you know, a nation's mourning and certainly shock at a horrific event. But he also used the opportunity, I think, to express a big, broad sense of what Americans love most about themselves, which is their resilience and their, you know, their hope amid dark times. And so I think he embodied the tone that everybody's really seeking right now.
Mm-hmm. And I was interested in, because I had my antenna up for this, not the slightest comment that could be interpreted as partisan, was there? Or did I miss something?
He didn't need to. And watching this speech, especially when he talked about the 9-year-old girl, you had to have in mind that the president's, of course, right, clearly was thinking of his own daughters. And so I think in that context, he was speaking of as a father as well as the president. And I think that was very poignant and very personal. And that was very far away from anything political.
We have a couple minutes before we have to take a break. Now, back to Sarah Palin. Commentators slammed her for employing this phrase, blood libel, a term coined centuries ago in reference to anti-Semitic rumors that Jews killed Christian children to use their blood in rituals. Now, what happened here? Could Sarah Palin have handled this better? She obviously could have chosen different words, but I'm wondering, how fair is it to criticize her for using this term blood libel, a term that most of us never heard before this?
Well, you know, the remainder of her speech, it was interesting. The tone, the setting, the the style with which she delivered it was really interesting because it seemed to be in stark contrast to the use of the term blood libel. It was measured. It was, it was obvious that she was trying to put forward a much more toned down kind of perception of who she is and what she has to offer. She wanted to be a statesman of sorts, a stateswoman of sorts, and to put herself forward as a national political figure who could speak in those same measured tones that we hear from Obama in situations like this. And the use of the term blood libel, it was that kind of red meat somewhere in there that she seems unable to resist. So, you know, it's hard to believe that it was not, that it wasn't noticed beforehand, that there wasn't some knowledge of what she was putting out there. It's a code word, a code phrase that I think means a lot to a lot of people, and she had to know it.
Okay, Rachel Caulfield, hang on. Dennis Goldford in our studios in Des Moines. We'll come back with more of Politics Wednesday here on The Exchange. When we come back, the China visits, the rise of China. What do you think about that? Your thoughts, questions, concerns as you see the rise of China in relation to the United States. 1-866-780-9100. The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Back in just a few minutes. Great to have you with us on this edition of The Exchange over the noon hour here on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow at this time, I talk with Patricia Kelly, a prominent female paleontologist. She'll tell us how she navigates her faith and reconciles its stories of creation with her study of evolution. Also tomorrow during the hour, we learn about a program which seeks to encourage more young women to follow career paths into science and technology. Today it's Wednesday. That means it's Politics Wednesday here on The Exchange. and our guests, Rachel Caulfield and Dennis Goldford of Drake University, chewing the political fat. And we talked about healthcare this first half hour. We want to move on from that topic to talk about the budget hearing last night in Des Moines in just a few minutes. Maybe an update on judicial impeachment, a new poll out there. First of all, let's quickly touch on the China visit this morning. Barack Obama laid on a pomp-filled ceremony for his Chinese counterpart, Hu Jintao, at the White House, saying the United States welcomed his country's rise to, quote, a strong, prosperous, and successful member of the community of nations. And I want to talk to Rachel and Dennis here about the issues you see that are most challenging for U.S.-China relations. May I turn to you first of all, Dennis?
Well, one of the main things that American companies are concerned about in this regard is their inability to break into the Chinese market. You've got something like 1.6 billion people. They are over five times the population of the United States. And American companies see this as a huge market. However, their argument has been that Chinese companies, with the active assistance of the Chinese government, have made it very difficult for American companies to get into that market on equal terms and a level playing field. Mm-hmm. So they're very concerned about that. Additionally, they're concerned about the Chinese currency. I always have difficulty remembering. I think it's the renminbi. The Chinese have engaged in a lot of renminbi diplomacy, providing aid and financial assistance and actually buying things various countries around the world. It's been very successful in their becoming active players in the world stage through a kind of renminbi diplomacy as opposed to any kind of military diplomacy. But the question is whether the Chinese are keeping this currency too weak, that makes their goods and services very cheap for us to buy. And some in the U.S. think it should be allowed to appreciate, become more costly, which, of course, would raise the prices of all these goods we find with the sign made in China.
Mm-hmm. In terms of these business concerns, what leverage does the United States have? We owe the Chinese a lot of debt. What is there for leverage for our negotiators?
Not much, actually.
No, I was gonna say, we don't.
There's an old phrase at the individual level, you know, if you owe the bank $1,000, you're in trouble. If you owe the bank $1 million, the bank's in trouble. And the Chinese own, I think I saw a figure just yesterday in anticipation of Hu's visit, the Chinese own something like 6% of American debt. And if they were to sell dollars, for example, and move to the euro, they would hurt their own holdings because that would cause a run and decrease the value of the dollar. So the very value of what they hold would dissolve before their eyes. But at the same time, there doesn't seem, and I'm not an economist in this regard, but there doesn't seem to be a lot of leverage we do have.
Mm-hmm. How do other issues we hear about in Sino-U.S. Relations fit into this? Human rights, Taiwan, of course, for decades, North Korea popping up in the news in recent years, Tibet. How does that fit in against this backdrop of business concerns and the U.S. trade deficit with China?
Well, you know, economically, the U.S. is inextricably linked to China. There's no going back in terms of our economic relationship. In the past, prior to such integration, such wholesale integration from an economic front, in the past, the U.S. has really tried to use some sense of moral authority and moral diplomacy to you know, work with China on issues of human rights and work with China on issues of sovereignty, and improving a record of treatment of Chinese citizens. And the more we start to owe China and the bigger China gets from an economic perspective, the less bargaining power we have with China. And so these issues persist, and yet our ability to, you know, to really try to force China's hand on these issues gets weaker and weaker.
How do China and the U.S. view each other increasingly as we look toward the future? Partners, competitors? How do we categorize?
I would say
this?
Competitors. I wouldn't say enemies, but I would say certainly competitors. I mean, I'm old enough to remember the big debates over, and it was a standard topic in a formal debates in high schools and colleges for years, should Red China be admitted to the United Nations? And I just remember the hearings that were held on China, especially during the Vietnam War and so forth. You know, that was 40 years or so ago, and people talked about China then as the enemy until President Nixon went to meet Mao and try to split China away from the Russians and break up the old communist bloc in that regard. But the Chinese are certainly competitors. And the Chinese are a very proud culture. They had a civilization for thousands of, or at least centuries of time, in which they saw themselves as the dominant power in the world. And with the age of European imperialism and colonization, the Chinese smarted terribly under the fact that the Europeans had various rights in China during the 19th century, for example, that infringed on Chinese sovereignty. And so much of what China's diplomacy has been engaged in really since the consolidation of communist power after 1949 was to reestablish what they see as China's rightful role in the world. With the U.S. as the most powerful country in the world, it's inevitable that they'll tend to bump into each other in all sorts of spots around the world.
But I think that's absolutely true. I think the language, however, of international conversations is about partnership. So we're going to hear a lot about partnership. But I think realistically, we're talking about competition.
Rachel Caulfield with us, along with Dennis Goldford of Drake University. We want to turn now to a couple items of state concern within the state, that is. The budget hearing last night, Iowans concerned about state spending cut plans took their opinions to the Iowa Capitol last night. For more than 3 hours, they rallied for or against state-paid preschool for all four-year-olds, state spending to help Iowans stop smoking, and a plan to put millions of dollars from the budget surplus into a tax relief account. Ken Sager is president of the Iowa Federation of Labor, AFL-CIO. He opposes the bill, saying it costs state workers jobs at a time when Iowans are demanding new jobs.
Where are the jobs? That's the number one concern of Iowans these days. But the first bill to come out of the Iowa House is a real job killer. House File 45 makes a series of cuts in funding totaling up to $500 million. But dig deeper and you'll find that when the funding goes away, so do the jobs, not to mention the services that Iowa families depend on. Here are a few examples. Scrapping the voluntary state-funded preschool program would eliminate over 1,000 jobs. Funding for area education agencies is being cut $10 million and will jeopardize good-paying professional jobs like psychologists and speech clinicians. Cuts in funding to services to elderly will adversely impact an industry that employs tens of thousands of Iowans. Cutting for funding for the passenger rail service will eliminate 190 construction jobs, as well as full-time jobs that are necessary for rail transportation management after the system is built. These are good jobs, jobs paying $50,000 to $60,000 a year. At the same time we are cutting jobs that provide services to our most vulnerable, there is not a same similar fervor to eliminate or even limit hundreds of millions of dollars that businesses get in subsidies and tax credits.
Ken Sager, president of the Iowa Federation of Labor, AFL-CIO, speaking last night at the budget hearing in Iowa's Capitol. For an opposing view, or rather spoke in favor of the bill, Heather Stansel of Earlham spoke in favor of the bill, saying that taxpayers need a break.
This is a very difficult bill. Nothing on this bill is going to make everybody happy. Just listening to the speakers that spoke tonight, nobody's happy about everything. But we need to make some difficult choices. We don't have the money. We can't fund everything. We're not going to make everybody happy. We can, however, make taxpayers happy. I'm a taxpayer. I'm tired of being the one that the government goes to all the time to fix the budget. We have to make difficult choices. My husband and I make difficult choices all the time. We want jobs. Iowans want jobs. We want our taxes to go down. I've never been given a job by a poor man. In fact, I'm employed by a rich man. So I really don't want to hear any more about corporations being the bad guy. They're the ones that employ me. They pay my health insurance, and they give me a paycheck every week.
Heather Stancil of Earlham speaking in favor of the state spending cut plans, the bill, saying taxpayers need a break. We'd like to reach out to you in these final minutes of the exchange today. Listeners, what are your thoughts as this budget hearing took place last night as Governor Branstad serves his first term returning to office? What are your budget priorities for the state? 1-866-780-9100. What do you fear getting cut? What are you glad about that you hear that is new from the state capitol? 1-866-780-9100, the exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Rachel Caulfield, Denniford, tell me your observations about spending priorities, your observations about the politics of events like the hearing last night on House Republicans' Taxpayers First Act.
There's a wonderful acronym that's really appropriate here that Rachel and I are familiar with. It's called the NIMBY syndrome. And NIMBY, of course, stands for not in my backyard. In other words, everybody says, yes, the government's budget is a mess. We've got to cut spending, but not in my backyard. In other words, let's cut spending that affects other constituencies. That's waste, that's fraud, that's useless spending. But spending on matters of concern to me is necessary. It's really important and worthwhile. Everybody says that. Americans as a whole, on the one hand, don't like paying taxes. On the other hand, Americans want a certain level of government services. And those two desires clash with each other.
Mm-hmm. And with what result in this case, do you think?
Well, the Republicans have the majority in the House, so they tend to be inclined to focus more on, as Ms. Stancil said, the needs of taxpayers, although the taxpayers tend to be more in the business community and people who are better off. The Democrats focus on jobs, and that'll be a concern in the Democratic Senate, although it's a fairly thin margin for the Democrats there, 26-24 after last night's special election. They're going to be some cuts somewhere, particularly with the Republican governor. And I think the Democrats in the Senate are simply going to try to play defense for the matters of concern to them.
Will it these budget cuts, will they affect a majority of Iowans or enough Iowans that it would change the view about cutting the budget in this way?
I think it's fair to say that the majority of Iowans will be affected in some way. this is statewide policy. This concerns, you know, our taxes and our school systems and our healthcare systems, and there's some universal effects here. I think, you know, we end up in these situations. We constantly, and this goes back to kind of talking through our uncivil discourse, we constantly say that we want an adult conversation about priorities. And what strikes me is that when it comes time to actually have that adult conversation about priorities, you know, we hear from familiar constituencies. We hear from the business community and we hear from the labor community. But I think what's remarkable is that when you get a group of average Americans in a room together and ask them what their budget priorities are, you actually find remarkable consensus. And people, you know, we absolutely want to pay less in taxes and we want more in services. But on the whole, if you ask people to be realistic, they get it. They understand that's an impossible formula moving forward. And so I think, you know, this exercise in asking people to speak about their concerns is a really important one. And I think the legislators should be listening.
Eric in Des Moines is with us. We're running out of time. Eric, do you have a quick point to make?
Yeah, I heard the comment a couple times that you played by. I think it was Heather at the meeting last night talking about how she's never been employed by a poor person, how she gets a paycheck from a rich man who owns a company. And I just want to take issue with that. I've run several small businesses. I know several people who do. We're not all rich, and she does not get a paycheck. She works and may get paid in return. But these rich people, I'm giving this class warfare issue, it's much more people fighting for the rights of rich people to have tax cuts compared to poor people standing up for for fairness in the tax system. And I think people need to take a look at the reality. The super, super rich pay lower taxes than almost anybody else as a percentage of their income. They don't pay Social Security tax on most of their income. They don't even pay regular income tax on dividends and capital gains. And, the rhetoric on all the class warfare, I mean, it's pretty much one-sided. And I'm just tired of all the comments, that rich people create jobs. Consumers create jobs. People work for their money. Rich people are not just giving money away.
Eric, thank you for your comment, that perspective from Des Moines. Okay. Before our ends here, I wanted to get an update on the judicial impeachment campaign. According to two new independent state polls, Iowa voters are solidly opposed to impeaching four state Supreme Court justices. A poll released by Justice Not Politics and the Justice at Stake campaign. The poll said 54% opposed calls to impeach the justices. 36% said they were in favor of impeaching the justices. That over a 2009 decision by the Iowa Supreme Court that permitted same-sex marriage. Rachel, you are a research fellow with the American Judicature Society, Hunter Center for Judicial Selection at Drake. Mm-hmm. Your comment on these polls?
Well, I think, it indicates that Iowans on the whole have a kind of bigger vision of what the courts are than a single decision. And I think that's a promising development. Certain that the courts are happy to hear that. Mm-hmm. When you use the specific language of the Constitution in terms of the grounds for impeachment, that is a misdemeanor or malfeasance, you find that the percent that supports impeaching a justice for any single decision drops to 17%.
So does this meet the standard for impeachment?
I think what's being made pretty clear is that the Iowa voters don't think so. Mm-hmm. The standard of malfeasance is one that's used in many states, and across the board, it is not used to remove justices or judges for a single unpopular decision.
Now, we have to remember that Bob Vanderplaats, who is in charge of this campaign, as he was in the campaign not to retain the three justices who did end up losing their jobs. He wasn't given much of a chance on the retention vote either when he began that campaign. So what chance does Bob Vanderplaats and others like-minded people have in changing the minds here if these poll results accurately reflect the state of people's views on this?
I would just add quickly that the poll results may be accurate, but it doesn't matter if those people don't show up to vote.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think, first of all, Bob Vanderplaats has indicated that his preference is for the justices to step down in an orderly fashion, voluntarily. He has not so far been leading the impeachment effort. That's largely been three new legislators who have said that they will put forward a bill to impeach. And so Bob Vanderplaats is kind of behind the scenes on the impeachment effort. He has indicated that if the justices refuse to resign, then he could conceivably support impeachment, and he envisions that as a viable alternative. I think impeachment is one of those very sticky situations, and it's true at the federal level and it's true at the state level. These standards are so vague that I think the political will matters tremendously. I don't know what high crimes and misdemeanors are. I know what treason is. I think everyone knows what treason is. So at the federal level, we're pretty clear on that. High crimes and misdemeanors seems a little bit clearer in that it directly invokes a crime, but impeachments have happened without a direct crime occurring. In the history of Iowa politics, only three individuals have been impeached. We don't have a clear standard of what misdemeanor or malfeasance means, but in other states, it has clearly not been used to mean disagreement with a single decision.
We have just over a minute left, and I'd like to swivel back to national politics for a quick closing comment from each of you. The State of the Union address by the president is just days away at the beginning of next week. What do each of you believe the president would be wise to emphasize in this address? And I have about 30 seconds for each of you, if I can start off with you, Dennis.
You recall after the 1994 takeover of the House and the Senate by the Republicans, President Clinton was forced to say, I'm still relevant. I think President Obama has to put himself front and center as the key player in what goes on in Washington through this State of the Union address.
Okay. Rachel?
And I would agree 100% with that. I would also add that, you know, on the heels of his Memorial Day speech in Arizona, that he has a real opportunity to continue that kind of national voice and big picture perspective, which the American people seem to really be responding to right now.
Do you think he's getting back in touch or learned a lesson that he got away from the voice that made him so popular during the campaign, and he's getting back in touch with that?
I think he's being given some opportunities, or he's faced some situations that have provided opportunities for him to go back to his strengths, which is to transcend the everyday politics.
I want to thank you very much. Rachel Caulfield with us, Dennis Goldford for the hour from Drake University. It's been a pleasure having you, as always, on our program. Thank you very much, Rachel and Dennis.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
The Exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer. We had production assistance today from Lindsay Moon. Technical support from Dennis Reese. In Des Moines, help from John Pemble. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.